hope is not something that we have as a possession, something that we can just acquire, right? If we're patient, or if we pray hard enough, or if we ask politely, or whatever framing you might have. I want to say that hope is an activity. I want to say that hope is a disposition, and it's closely joined to love. And so for me, when people say, what gives you hope? What gives me hope is the possibility for love. And so when people ask whether or not they should have hope, I say, well, do you find anything in the world, in your community, in your circles of relationship, worth loving? And if you do, then you're acting on hope, because love presupposes that the effort to care for another, the effort to care for a place, is worth the effort.
Norman Worsby is Gilbert T. Rowe Distinguished Professor of Christian Theology and Senior Fellow at the Kenan Institute for Ethics at Duke University. The author of several books, he's also the director of a multi-year Henry Luce Foundation-funded project titled Facing the Anthropocene. We talk with him today about his sobering and powerful new book on that subject, This Sacred Life, Humanity's Place in a Wounded World. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Going to begin today with an apology. Normally, I conduct these interviews from BYU, where I have fancy audio equipment, but today I'm snowed in my home a long ways from campus. But I do have a tremendous guest, Norman Worsby. Thank you so much, Norman, for taking time to talk with me today on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Matthew. It's good to be with you.
I begin by asking my guests how faith figures into their life and work. And with this book that you've written, titled This Sacred Life, you've written something that could be described as eco-theology. So I guess my question is multi-part. Were you raised in a religious tradition? If so, do you still affiliate with that tradition? And did that tradition inform the thinking that went into this book?
Yeah, sure. That's a good question. I think for sure, my upbringing plays a major role in this book, because I grew up in a farming community in southern Alberta, and these were people who took the work of farming very seriously. And for them, it was crucial to communicate in their work that farms, and by that they meant the animals, the fields, the plants, were all gifts from God, and they were to be cherished. And this is a sensibility that, of course, is so different from today's agribusiness, which really thinks about land, plants, animals as commodities. And so the example of my forebears, my family, my grandparents especially, was really important in helping me see that there is a very different way to think about this earth, and also how we think about the life on it. And because I lived at that sort of intersection of industrial versus animal husbandry traditions of agricultural practice, I saw how these two logics of commodity versus gift really play themselves out. And it was fairly clear to me that the path of industrial commodification is really destructive of planet, plant, and animal, and human life. And so that became a real foundational context for me to be thinking about issues that, you know, at that time I would not have thought that I would ever write a book called This Sacred Life, but they certainly are deeply embedded within me.
Yeah, you know what, that is interesting to me that you grew up in that way. And I think that that kind of deep understanding really informs the book in ways that are both obvious, its topics, its themes, but also subtle. There's a lot of really great subtle insights in the book, Norman, that bespeak a deep familiarity with these subjects, and not just bookish understanding of them by reading, you know, good articles in The Atlantic or wherever.
Right. Right? So well, that's kind of you to say, but I think, and this is, you know, something I talk about with students. You know, you get people who, you know, they've lived in suburbs or cities their whole life, and they read a Wendell Berry essay, and they're just captivated. And I tell them, if you're captivated now on a cognitive level, wait until the experience of being in a very practical, intimate relationship with land or plants or animals begins to take hold in you. And you will see layers to your understanding, and sort of it's an effective kind of understanding that is realized through your engagement. It's not just a conceptual exercise, right? And I think what's so important is to be able to help people imagine, and I use imagine very expansively here, a way of being, right? Not just a job, but a way of being in the world. And that's multifaceted because it has to register certainly in your head, but also in your heart and in your gut and in your hands and in your feet. And so it's a full-bodied kind of engagement that works itself out in the day-to-day. And that's really what informs the mind then, so it can be thinking in these more, I think, richly nuanced ways.
Yeah, sure. I love that definition, by the way, of imagination, this way of being. The podcast title, Faith and Imagination, is all about that kind of thing. So you're speaking the language here. Yeah, very much. One thing, let me ask you, the theological dimensions of the book, the aspects, you know, the thoughts that you have about God's creation and how that animates your argument and how we need to care for the earth. I found so rich how that part of your book really helps connect your argument to other faith traditions, to the sciences, cultures, societies. In other words, you manage in the book to make theology a tool for connecting rather than dividing people, and that is not easy to do. So is this a perspective that you've had to learn to cultivate, or has theology always served for you as a vehicle to link you with others, even those of different creeds?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And I think for me, you know, I studied theology at graduate school level, but I also did a PhD in philosophy. And I've always been drawn to the really fundamental questions. And those questions invariably take you into spiritual traditions, because those tend to be the traditions that keep alive the major questions of life and death and meaning and purpose. And, you know, a lot of philosophy maybe doesn't do that anymore because it's been sort of taken over by analytic approaches or highly technical scientific approaches as to mind, for instance. But I've always thought that the best philosophical traditions connect with people in their day-to-day experience. And that brings us to basic questions like, what does it mean to be a human being? What kind of a world do we live in? And, you know, so many of the great religious traditions of the world, and I would put in that group also indigenous traditions, they've been thinking and working these questions out for a very, very long time. And so to not engage them, I think, is a serious oversight. And as you said, I want it to be very clear that this would be a book that someone who is not necessarily Christian would want to read, because it uses a variety of voices. It also puts them in touch with, I hope, are things that they are already thinking about, and hopefully will illuminate them by using anthropological insights, cultural historical insights, indigenous insights, but then also Jewish and Christian insights. And, you know, as I say in the preface, this is a book in which, you know, I invite other people to think with me, because I don't claim to have answered or solved the questions about where are we or who are we or what should we do. These are perennial questions. They're enormous. They're complicated. But I thought thinking them together might be illuminating. And that's what I tried to do in the book.
I think it's great. The book really exemplifies that, Norman. And I just the list of endorsers at the front is already very impressive and really diverse. I mean, it really speaks well to the range of people to whom you're really speaking with this book. This is a book I would describe as a major book. It's an important book. It's a book that will have a long, like, shelf life, and will kind of be a book a lot of people refer to as kind of a touchstone text on this subject. I wonder if you could summarize then the book's argument for listeners not yet familiar with it.
Yeah, sure. So I start with the assumption that people are in some confusion about what it means to live on this planet, because we see efforts, for instance, by wealthy people, but also government-funded projects, to plan an escape for human beings, or at least some human beings, to go live somewhere else, right? So we're hearing active conversation about terraforming Mars now, and this is being put out by very serious people. So that was very disconcerting. Obviously, we're living in a time of climate change, which again, in many other manifestations, is not just a warming temperature, but we're talking about degraded ecosystems of all sorts. And these are, again, high indicators that human beings have somehow lost their way about how we should live on this planet. Because if the ways that we live, that we think promote human success, lead us to a position where we're rendering so much of this world uninhabitable, or if our thinking about the best human life requires, as in some transhumanist forms, an exceeding of the human condition altogether, so we become something we do not even yet know what it is, kind of reality, that again bespeaks a real confusion about what does it mean to be human in a world where we are doing so much damage to the possibility for our continuation on this planet. So I thought this is really an opportunity to raise some questions together, which often don't get put together in a very rigorous, systematic way. And those questions are, where are we? What kind of a world is it? Who are we? Right? What does it mean to be a human? And what should we do? And my answer was to say that we live in a place that's called God's creation. And I try to say why it matters to say that the world is God's creation and not simply natural nature or just random molecules moving around in a void. And I try to say that who we are as human beings is as God's creatures. And again, the question is, well, what difference does that make to say that we're creatures rather than, say, rational or political animals, as maybe Aristotle put it? And then the third part was, what should we do? And I wanted to say the fundamental human task is creativity, creative work that participates in the world's right transformation of itself. So putting these three logics together of creation, creatureliness, and creativity, I thought could be really generative. And the more I worked on the book, the more I realized how absolutely crucial it is to think these three together. So to use a simple example, if you believe that the world is a store, then the human task is to be a shopper and the human identity is to be a consumer. And those three logics work together beautifully, and they do work beautifully because we're seeing it worked out on the world stage right now. So I wanted to suggest that that naming of store, shopper, and shopping as a way to answer the big three questions has gotten us into a lot of trouble, and that maybe answering them as creation, creature, and creativity might give us a very different logic by which to think about humanity's place in the world.
I think that's so important, Norman. I love the, by the way, the, well, I love, first of all, the creation creature, you know, and creativity, but also the store, shopper, consumer. I think for a lot of people, in given the pandemic, I go back to March 2020, you couldn't find toilet paper, right. You know, you couldn't find cleaning supplies. There was so much concern about what this is going to mean, you know, we're going to bring the infection into our homes. I think that the idea for people now of a store where the goods are not there, right. You know, and where the assumption we make that it's always going to be there, no problem. I mean, this has been brought to mind a lot more in the pandemic that, look, this, you can't do this for granted.
That's
you
right,
know?
Right.
This is, it's a bad idea at some level.
Yeah. And I think we've also seen in this time of pandemic, how vulnerable the systems are that we think secure our living. And I don't think we can take for granted any longer. And this is also something that Earth system scientists are telling us. We can't take for granted that we're going to have fresh water, whether it's fresh water to be drinking or fresh water for irrigation. We can't take for granted soil, because we know that so much soil is eroding. We can't take for granted that we're going to have vital elements like phosphorus, which we need for fertilizer, or that we're going to have enough lithium deposits to mine to make all of the batteries that we're going to need for this electrified economy. So we're realizing that we're living in a world of limits, and what our consumer society has taught us, or at least has tried to teach us, is that there are no limits, right? There's a kind of limitlessness that's baked into so much of our thinking about how the economy can just provide endlessly. And there's no doubt that our economy is providing a great amount of goods, calories, and so forth. But if we can't continue to do that, you know, for the next several thousand years, which of course is a metric that not many economists are thinking in terms of, we're in trouble, right? And, you know, agriculture, which is an area that I especially focus on, right? We're looking at agricultural systems right now, which we don't think are going to last 50 years. We're thinking about aquaculture, our oceans and fisheries. we're looking at fish depletion, certain species, of happening within 20 to 30 years, right? So these are major questions, and we can't just stick our heads in the sand about these. We have to be thinking very carefully about what is required of us to shift from a mindset of limitlessness to a mindset of proper limits. And this, of course, is something that the whole idea of the human as a creature really tries to reinforce.
That's right. Learning to live with limits is such a mature exercise. And it doesn't, you know, you even think about like ideas about the child, you know, from psychology that you read from Freud or Lacan, you know, kind of the limitlessness or the boundlessness of the imagination, learning how to recognize limits and live within them. That really is a task for grownups. And it's not easy to learn.
Well, and it requires, I think, traditions and communities that really help cultivate in people, because, you know, when you live in a world that is so beset with limitlessness, it takes a community of people to help you learn to live within limits, because you can't do it by yourself. It's just too difficult to do.
It's a great point. And we live in a time that's so challenged for community at so many levels. You know, I'd love to talk with you about passages from your book here. And let me say up front that I only have time to get to a few passages, but there are so many in the book I've highlighted. Okay, this is a book with so many important insights. So if I may, let me maybe read a few of you, comment on them. If there are some that I don't get to that you want to get to, by all means, feel free to propose others. But here's one from the preface. You write, human efforts to design and engineer farms, forests, transportation networks, factories, and built urban environments while clearly producing multiple comforts and conveniences for a growing number of people have also depended on and required the destruction of places and communities consigned to commodification, exploitation, monoculture, abandonment, and toxic death.
Yikes.
Exactly. That's what I thought when I read it.
Yep. That's pretty tough. And I think, you know, the thing I'm trying to point to there is that we've not been honest with ourselves and with each other about the full costs of the kinds of economies we've put in place. And I think this is so, so important, because if we're looking at living in a world that is deeply wounded, which I think is beyond dispute, if we're looking at human communities that are growing more and more desperate because they're anxious about their futures, which I think is also beyond dispute, we can't live in a fairy tale world any longer. We can't keep trying to tell each other there's no problems. We can just handle things as they come. There's always going to be some technological solution. I think what we need is full, honest accounting in which we tally up the costs and the benefits. And we've not been doing that, right? So agriculture, as a prime example, has been producing more calories than the world has ever seen, but they're doing it at tremendous costs. And we're seeing now that these costs are not easily paid. And so the time for honesty, you know, to use your earlier language, it's time for us to grow up and realize that we can't just build hypothetical budgets and assume that somebody down the road is going to pay the costs that we've just been pushing off on to the next generation, right? In economics speak, we call these externalities. There are no more externalities because there are no more places to dump them to, right? The planet is full. The planet is fully deployed. And so we're going to have to learn to live with where we are. And that means being very clear-eyed about how some benefits have trade-offs, that some of the boons of our production entail sacrifice zones in which whole communities, whole regions are going to be sacrificed because they're going to be destroyed permanently. We need to be clear about that. And that's hard, right? And that's why this is a book for grown-ups, because there's some hard medicine that we need to deal with going ahead.
You know, that kind of description doesn't sound like you're describing large swaths of American society in the present as we live it. Are there societies, I'll ask this, are there Western societies where you see this mentality really settling in? Are you hopeful as you look at certain, I mean, there are lots of societies, indigenous, et cetera, that lived this way for a very long time. Do you see Western societies also starting to embrace this new important mentality?
Yeah, I think so. And this is where, you know, I especially appeal to younger readers, because the younger people that I engage, they're aware. They realize that they've been fed a bunch of garbage from my generation. They know we've been lying, which is why many of them are saying, I don't want your life. I don't want your goals. I want something very, very different. And so, you know, whether it's, you know, young climate activists who are saying, don't give me your hope, I don't believe it, to people who are saying, it's time for us to try something vastly different. So young people, I think, are people who are really wise, more wise than we often give them credit for, about the state of our planet, which is, you know, one of the reasons, you know, they're so enamored with the eco-apocalyptic genre, right? They've known where we're heading. And it's people who are in positions of financial and government leadership who keep their head in the clouds, assuming it will just keep on the journey as we've set it, and it's all going to work out in the end. It's not going to work out in the end, as these people are suggesting. So, you know, one of the things that I try to do is I try to encourage young people to be vocal, right? Get more energized about this, because we're going to need you to criticize and keep criticizing the falsity that is being pronounced by my generation.
That's great. And my daughters, if they heard that, would say, yeah, Dad, right? You're speaking right. Their language, Norman. Here's another passage that you wrote. Is again, toward the first part of the book, you wrote that although science has tremendous potential to teach us about the land, so far it has not shown itself to be especially good at helping people live by and with, rather than on or against it.
Right. Yeah. So there, I'm talking about how certain ways of describing our planet make it fairly amenable to extraction. Okay, so for instance, if you look at what a lot of science departments are doing at research universities, many of them are really working towards what we call applied science, which means they're trying to develop the technologies, the kinds of patents that will enable the most efficient appropriation of it. So again, to use agriculture, right? It's not as though botanists are trying to design plants, tomatoes, cucumbers, whatever, with the highest nutritional value in them. Instead, they're being designed so as to have a long transportation, a long shelf life, which means that they're not being bred, right, for the benefit of human beings. They're not being bred with the idea that we're really trying to develop a whole ecosystem approach to food production. Well, this is a use of science, which again is not assuming that human beings are supposed to live with the world in ways that are mutually beneficial, right? One of the people in my book that I refer to often is Robin Kimmerer, who's this wonderful indigenous writer and botanist. And she talks about how about making plants our teachers, right? That conception of science, which again, this is a serious scientific approach that has not just been the purview of indigenous peoples, right? Goethe, one of the great German philosophers and scientists, said, what we need is an exact sensorial imagination, right? And what he meant by that is that we become the students of what we study rather than just the sort of observers from a distance and doing the observing with the aim of being able to manipulate and then appropriate for ourselves. It's a radically different scientific stance. And I need to be clear, I'm not anti-science, yeah. Right? The job of science is to help us understand the world. The question is, what do we do with science? And that's often a question that we don't get to talk about very much, because science is always an interested activity. And right now, so many of the interests are economic, right? Because as you know, universities are getting strapped for funding all the time. And so they're looking for agencies, corporations that will fund them. And what we're learning is that these corporations often have an agenda, right? So that you should be doing research that benefits their financial aims. And so it's a question about what do we understand science to be, what science is for, And I think if we can have that conversation as a culture, and especially given our location in universities, as university leaders, that can be all to the good, because one of the things that's important for us to acknowledge is that so much of the research that has done so much to bring about pain and suffering to our world and to our communities, much of that research has happened in universities.
Yeah, sure has. I'm grateful you mentioned Robin Kimmerer as one example. You make an insight observation later in the book that I liked a lot. You said that sciences that we need sciences that are responsive to the best insights of the world's religious and spiritual traditions, which really doesn't mean that looking for a different physics, but to ask questions about what these things are for and how they serve a larger good. We need things that are deeply ethically and philosophically and theologically informed to be able to ask larger questions about, what does this yield more than simply profit margin? There's a lot more at stake than just even something important like job production, though as important as that is, it's not the great end all and be all of our existence.
Yeah. And I think, Wendell Berry, who I'm a big fan of, has this great way of describing our situation, which is to say that so much of the research that we do in our universities is in a very narrow scope. In other words, the context of consideration where we ask the bigger questions about how does this scientific project affect the larger context of society, of political organizations, of economic systems, of community well-being, of public health, those questions don't get asked. And if you look at, just to use Duke as an example, we have a very fine school of engineering called the Pratt School of Engineering. And not so long ago, the dean, who has now left to go somewhere else, but was a very wise dean, said, look, at the engineering school, we can make anything pretty much. What we need help with is figuring out whether or not we should do anything. Right? What are the aims? What are the contexts that we need to be thinking about so that we can deliberate more effectively, more beneficially, more praiseworthily about the varying engineering projects we are going to undertake? And so, for instance, one example that we can point to is the idea that we're going to terraform other planets. Right? This is getting major traction from very wealthy, influential people. It's an utter fantasy, because it doesn't ask the larger questions about how is a human being who can only, and this is important to stress, who can only live in the biosphere that we have on Earth, how are we possibly going to terraform Mars, which is not at all friendly to the biosphere that our bodies need, right? Our gut biomes cannot survive on Mars. But apparently Elon Musk has never bothered to think about the gut biome. He needs to, because if he did, he would realize how ridiculous his notion is.
I think Elon Musk should take more seriously the SNL skit that had the guy on Mars. Chad, is that the guy's name? Anyway, it didn't end well. Okay. Musk needs to remember that skit, take that to heart. And that's a great point, Norman. Ray, great point. You mentioned really wise the words of that dean, the former dean of the engineering school at Duke, about the things that are praiseworthy. Let me ask you about praise here. You have a great observation in your book. You say the sounds of mourning, and no matter how frequent, pervasive, or necessary they might become, are not the most fundamental. They are premised upon and derive their urgency from creation's more primordial posture of praise.
Yeah.
That was a really, I think, poignant observation.
Yeah. So, there's so many ways to get into this question. I think one way is when you look at cultures around the world, it's very clear that in the ways that they think about themselves, their world, their built environments, their art, there is an affirmation of the world as fundamentally good and beautiful, that being itself is good. Now, what we see, of course, is that in certain traditions that come along later, there's growing suspicion about the goodness of the world. And a lot of that suspicion arises from what human beings have done to their places, right? So right now, we're living in a time where young people, they're caught in time because they look to the past, and what do they see? But they see these incredibly excruciating histories of violence and violation. And they don't want anything to do with that. And they look at a future, a climate change future, where there are diminished prospects. So they're orphans in time. This is new, right? One of the great works of any culture is to help its young come into the continuity of time, where they don't have to accept everything about the past as having been good, but they realize that in the work of the past, that affirmation of goodness is carried forward, that affirmation of beauty is carried forward, so that they then can become participants in its continuation. Now, that's something that is so, so important to communicate and cultivate in the generations of our world. But it's very, very difficult to do because we are now so aware, and you know, a 24/7 global news cycle just reinforces this over and over again, that human beings seem to be really good at destroying, at violating, but not so good at nurturing, celebrating. And so this is important then to say, because we're in a moment where lament is absolutely important. We need to be honest about the past, but we can't move forward if we don't also lift up the goodness and beauty of this world. That is the most fundamental thing, because if you give up on goodness and beauty, or what I call the world's fundamental hospitality, right, that this world is hospitable to the generation of ever new forms of life. If we give up on goodness, beauty, hospitality, then we're really lost, because the bases for trying to mount any kind of constructive effort that will build communities, that will nurture habitats, heal broken relationships, the impetus for that disappears once goodness, beauty, and hospitality disappear.
That's a great insight. I keep wanting to kind of break into applause, Norman, at these insights you're sharing. It's fantastic. I love it. I've got time to ask you about another couple of passages here and a couple other large questions kind of at the conclusion here. But here's a passage. Let me read this to you and ask you a question about it, actually. Okay. You write, at the middle of the book, you write, "The idea of life is divinely created and therefore also communicating a divine intention that affirms the goodness of this given world. Give us some means for both evaluating particular events as catastrophic and as calling people to work for creation's emancipation and burgeoning." My question about that is, can this point be made simply through kind of empirical evidence, you know, or a sound argument, or does it require kind of a faith perspective in order to affirm? Yeah, and if the latter, how does one inspire faith in that kind of principle?
Yeah, no, that's also a really good question. I think there are multiple ways into it, but I think I would start by trying to draw people more closely to their own experience of this world. And that's going to be different for different folks, obviously. But if we use an example that I use frequently, but if you think about the experience of gardening, growing food, which is something, or you know, gathering food, hunting food, whatever, this is something that has been central, fundamental to most of human history. We're in the unusual position in the last 100 years or so of not having to think about where our food comes from or how we're going to get it. This is totally new in the history of humanity. But for the rest of the 99.9% of human history, people have had food and its acquisition, its consumption, its sharing in their minds all the time. Okay. Now, if you're in these activities of growing or harvesting or foraging food, it doesn't take much for you to realize that you live by gifts. Okay, that's just becoming apparent to people. And this is something that students who get into gardening for the first time will tell me. They say, "I had no idea that I don't control this, that I can't just plant it and it happens." And so it unseats you as the center of the universe. And it makes you realize that you are the beneficiary of powers and fecundity and fertility, virility, but also suffering and pain that you didn't ever put in motion. So that becomes the beginning of an understanding of the world as gift rather than just as a bunch of stuff we can commodify and appropriate. Now, what cultures have done is they've tried to make sense of this very costly gift, because it's saturated with life and fertility, but also with suffering and pain and death. Different cultures have spend a lot of time. And this is where spiritual traditions become so important, because these become hermeneutical lenses by which different cultures make sense of this primordial experience that people have. And, you know, we could do the same thing by using energy versus food as the lens into this, right? But the point is to recognize that as these different cultures deal with this basic question about where does life come from? And it doesn't come from ourselves, that we then become open to an experience of what we might call the transcendent, or the experience of what different cultures go by with the name creator of a world. And so that it's no accident that many different traditions use this kind of language. And so when I try to articulate this language of the sacred, or this language of the creation, that's something that I'm wanting to tap into. So it's not that we come to it through a doctrinal path. The doctrinal path is working out what people are experiencing fundamentally through their own body, in the fact that they need to eat, that they need to warm themselves, that they need to build homes for themselves and for each other. That's the fundamental experience that different religions and spiritual traditions and indigenous traditions are trying to give some sort of narrative sense to. And this is what our scriptures do.
That's great. You know, one of your gifts, I think, Norman, as an academic, is great clarity. I mean, you obviously you think big thoughts, but there's a great facility for how to articulate them in ways that are both clear and compelling. And that's not an automatic for a lot of people who are academics. I mean, you know,
you're trying to say that, Matthew. Thank you.
And I'm wondering about this book here. It's such a thoughtful and insightful book. It's a sobering book. It's also an inspiring book. And it's got a real rigor of argument. There's a wide range of references. There's real sophistication philosophically to the book. As a fellow academic, raises some questions for me. Do you imagine a wide readership for this book? Or is it more like you imagine a wide academic readership, but not necessarily a popular readership? And the question I'm getting at is, a book with so much important, so many important things to say, what's the value of writing an academic book like about these kinds of things, as opposed to a book that's intended for a popular audience, you know, where you kind of go in some different directions with parts of the argument?
Right. Yeah. No, that's a really good question too. So yeah, I try to write with as little use of jargon as possible. And because I was trained in 19th and 20th century French and German philosophy, I know how jargon can go berserk. And it's frustrating to me that I've got, you know, colleagues that have written books where we spend the whole time trying to figure out what's the argument, what's the position. That's a waste of time. So for me, clarity is really important. And here I give a lot of credit to Wendell Berry, who really was a mentor to me in my own writing and has helped me enormously, because one of the things that's such a pleasure teaching his work, and there are others obviously besides him, but he's an example, is that students write in it right away. They know what he's talking about. We don't have to figure out what's he saying. We know what he's saying. The question is, what are we going to do with it? Now, I don't pretend that this book is one that, you know, a middle schooler is going to pick up and say, oh, I can't wait to read this. Because it is difficult, I admit that. But I also take comfort in the fact that with this book, I've had a number of people who are not theologians read it, ranging from professors to students, who say, "This, I understand this. I know what this is about." And that's really satisfying to me. So on the one hand, I wanted it to be a book that would be read not just by people in the theology, religious studies worlds. I really want it to be environmental humanities people that would pick it up. I also wanted it to be a book that you don't have to take in a class to understand, where you have professors who are guiding you through the paragraphs. If you're patient and read not too quickly, I think you can make it out what the book is about. And this has been my experience also with the previous book, Food and Faith. It was so gratifying to me to know that farmers were reading the book and understanding it. And I hope that a book like this will, you know, engage community members. It will engage environmentally activist types of people. And they won't be struggling with what is the position here. If they take their time, They'll figure it out. And I think that's really important to do. I think one of the pieces of advice that I got very, very early when I was in graduate school, it wasn't given to me orally, it was in written form, was from Thomas Merton, who said, we have a moral obligation as writers not to waste the time of our readers. Hmm. And I think that's absolutely right.
It's a profound piece of advice. Mm-hmm. And I'll add, I think that anybody listening to this podcast, this is a very readable book with big, important arguments, but very, very clear and beautifully articulated with some great insights. I didn't ask you about various other passages in the book, but you've got great observations about the Sabbath, for example, and about core principles of creativity. And there's so much wonderful stuff in the book, Norman, that is, I think, really beautifully laid out. And I'm grateful to you for writing it. I've got maybe a question or two here at the end here. I wanted to ask you about, you know, if one surveys the range of ongoing environmental catastrophes in the world, right? You know, global warming and climate change, species loss, disproportionate share of ecological injustice suffered by the poor, and so right. on. There's a lot of cause for alarm. But as you consider where we are today relative to the issues about which you write, do you find causes there for genuine hope?
Yeah.
If so, what might one or two of those causes for hope be?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, oh boy, this is so many things to bring into play here. I think, first of all, we have to acknowledge that hope does not depend on knowing the outcome, right? That's very, very important. Because one of my fundamental claims is that it is hugely presumptuous for any of us to claim to know the outcome. We don't. We can talk fairly generally about all sorts of things that you mentioned that are very, very concerning. And the point is not to try to just push them aside and assume that everything's going to be all right. That's the kind of hope that is a disaster. So we have to be honest. We also have to be humble, and we have to not, you know, engage in presumptuous prediction, right? So that's one thing. The second thing I want to do is about the question of hope is say that hope is not something that we have as a possession, something that we can just acquire, right? If we're patient, or if we pray hard enough, or if we ask politely, or whatever framing you might have. I want to say that hope is an activity. I want to say that hope is a disposition, and it's closely joined to love. And so for me, when people say, what gives you hope? What gives me hope is the possibility for love. And so when people ask whether or not they should have hope, I say, well, do you find anything in the world, in your community, in your circles of relationship worth loving? And if you do, then you're acting on hope, because love presupposes that the effort to care for another, the effort to care for a place, is worth the effort. And as Rebecca Solnit, who's written a wonderful little book on this called Hope in the Dark, says, hoping always happens without certainty. It always happens in conditions of turmoil. And we have to remember that, you know, throughout human history, people have believed they are at the end of the world, right? That the destruction is so awful. And I'm not trying to minimize previous accounts of destruction. So, you know, just to use an example of my parents growing up in World War II, 1945, summer dawns, Europe is a wasteland, literally. It's a scene of unspeakable desolation, destruction, brutality, chaos, confusion. They really did think the world had come to an end. And they thought there was no reason to have hope, but guess what? These people learn to love in the context of desolation and destruction. And that becomes the basis for anybody to be thinking about rebuilding, about turning their energy and their skill into the exercise of care, or the exercise of healing, or the exercise of reparations, or correcting injustice, or building peaceable communities, right? All of these possibilities depend on inspiring love in people. And so I want to, most often when I can, turn the question of hope into the question of love.
That's beautiful. I love that. Thank you. You know, it seems to me that any long-term solution to environmental catastrophe is going to involve politics. So it's going to be a political solution.
Right.
But can you envision a solution that does not also draw extensively on religion? And I ask that question because my question would be then, how do you make that argument, that case, to those who are of a more secular mindset? That say, right. No, the answer is going to be through science, and politics and religion gets in the way.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the key there is to just have the conversation going, because I don't want to for a minute suggest that if you are not ostensibly religious, that you don't have something to contribute to the conversation. I mean, you know, my book's title is This Sacred Life. A book that I greatly respect is called This Life by Martin Haglund, and it's won all kinds of awards. And he's starting precisely from the opposite assumption that I am, which is to say there is nothing sacred, right? Religion is the problem, and develops a vision of democratic socialism, which in its policy recommendations, I wholly endorse, right? So reading Martin's book, This Life, is highly instructive. It's also edifying to me as someone who's not an atheist. So my hope is that Martin might read my book, This Sacred Life, and realize that we can be allies, and we need to have people coming from so many different points of view around this very fundamental question about whether or not human beings are going to be able to find a way to live beautifully, to live peaceably in a world that we are doing so much to harm and wound and destroy. That has to be the fundamental question that all of us, no matter where we are, whatever station in life we're in, have to be able to talk about intelligently and with a view to actually making some changes. And I'm pleased to think that religions have a big role to play in this. And it's also, I think, interesting to note that more and more people are seeing that religions play an important role, because they are, in many instances, the holders of great insight about moral formation, about aesthetic value, even though, as we know, their histories are saturated with a violation of the very principles they are called to espouse.
Yeah, it's great. You know, it's interesting you mentioned the Martin Haglund book. So I'm not an atheist either, but I assigned that book in the class I taught last year. And I find it also a fascinating book. And, right. And I love the thought about that you articulate here about being able to sort of create conversations, points of very much shared philosophy and shared point of view, shared urgency.
Yeah.
For these really big, important questions. Thank you so much, Norman, for writing this book. It's a beautiful book. And I think it's going to have deserves a very wide readership. It's going to get that readership, I believe. And thank you for taking the time to come and talk with me today. This has been great. I so appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Matthew. It's been a pleasure being with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.